Good morning. I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. With number, I think it's 35 of my screenside chats for our ACAP members. My goal with the chats is to share timely, practical, clinical practice information and other important information from experts on key topics during the COVID-19 pandemic. Reminiscent of President Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and World War II, I have wanted the topics to be informative, relevant, and interesting. My presidency is coming to an end, and I am now focusing on things that have to do with my presidential initiative about children with severe emotional outbursts who pose real treatment challenges. Last time I spoke with Dr. Jack McClellan, and we discussed what he thinks is important to the treatment of outbursts. He comes from the vantage point of running a unit in a large state hospital. Today we'll talk to Dr. Mike Sorter. Dr. Sorter is professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati Medical School and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. His major focus has been on expanding and improving clinical child psychiatric services for children and families at the Children's Hospital. And under his leadership, and he's been really impressive, under his leadership, there has been a progressive expansion of psychiatric services from one inpatient unit with 10 beds to a hospital service of 100 inpatient beds, 30 residential beds, 48 partial hospital beds, and over 82,000 outpatient encounters, as well as coordination services. He also co-chairs ACAP's Inpatient Psychiatry Committee, and it's in those roles that we're talking with him today. Dr. Sorter, we are confronting what ACAP is going to be highlighting, calling it the crisis in child mental health. And that's a broad sweep. But from the standpoint of being a director of a large clinical service, why don't you just review real quick what that crisis encompasses?
Well, sure. First of all, thank you very much for having me on today's chat, and it's a real privilege, and greatly appreciate it. And this issue that you're pointing to is we've reached in many ways a national crisis, really across the country. Emergency rooms are oftentimes being overrun by young people that are in acute crisis or families. And this issue about really emotional outbursts and dysregulation is a key factor in why kids come into the hospital and the emergency room. It's putting great pressure on systems of care really to meet the needs. And I think what has been demonstrated over the last really several years is that we're falling behind in our ability to really address when kids and families are in acute crisis, about intervening in a way that's supportive of them, that helps them really recover. The stress on the system also, I think, is the issue about flow keeps coming up. When you run an inpatient system or even outpatient care, is kids coming in and then being able to flow to different levels of care becomes kind of this critical issue, and oftentimes ends up driving a lot of the decision-making, perhaps when you don't want it to. And this is oftentimes because you really taking resources and trying to, how should I say, give them in a way, in the most kind of thoughtful way, so that you're providing good care, but you're still addressing the overwhelming demand that's really at the front door. The emergency rooms are the place that this kind of, I think is really the critical area. But it's the inpatient units and other systems are such as crisis stabilization or even residential care that need to do the treatment. And if we're pushing that too hard, we maybe aren't doing the best we can for kids and families.
And so it's a sort of a drinking from the fire hose analogy is the one that I like to think about. Kids come in, but we've just actually been looking at some of those data, Mike. A lot of those kids are repeaters. I mean, they've been in the hospital, they've been in the emergency room a number of times. It's not like they're treatment naive, and all we have to do is connect them up to an able-bodied clinician in the community who dusts his or her hands off, and, you know, we know how to fix this and everything's hunky-dory. These kids have really intractable difficulties. And so they come into the emergency room. The emergency room clinician decides, admit or not admit. If you don't admit, then you go to a system that isn't prepared to take care of the kid. And tell us what happens when you put them on the inpatient unit.
Well, that's a good point. I think, first of all, the idea that when we have these young people with these explosive outbursts, they're not isolated incidents. These are incidents that are repeating episodes that have severe impact on their really development, really trajectory of how they're going to develop over time, and also has implications for future pathology and difficulties. So we really do need to address what's going on. And you're right, is that when we don't really have the right fit for them, they can have incredible difficulty in challenging a medical system or boarded on an emergency room where we're really not meeting their needs, and they're just really disrupting the kind of the system itself. So we have to build this infrastructure better to really handle these kids and give them what they need.
So what would you do? We think of an inpatient unit as the final arbiter of a real serious problem. You know, we're going to fix you up, and your appendix is ruptured, and we're not going to send you out with pills. We've got to put you in the OR. I mean, you're sick, and so we do that. What happens there? How does that go awry? Where does the problem lie? It's not going to be a single problem. That's a silly thing to say. But where do you see the stressors? And if I could give you a magic lantern that you could rub and fix, what would you do?
Well, my sense is that we can help provide an environment where the young person can be safe. That's number one. We have to provide safety. And the magic wand piece would be is really, how do we effectively intervene with those families and the system that surrounds those kids to be much more effective in helping them mitigate the factors that cause them to have this dysregulation or explosive outbursts? Because we are in a short inpatient length of stay, we can do diagnostics, we can begin medication perhaps, we can make recommendations regarding what therapies are required, but we're not going to change all those basic contributing factors, but we can begin the plan to change those things. And then we need to effectively work with those outpatient systems to hand that child back to that family. What I think is oftentimes lacking is really, how are we intervening with mother, father, other caregivers that may be involved to really change the environment so that we give that kid every opportunity to succeed. And so that's really why it's a multidisciplinary, it's many people involved, it's care management, that really the inpatient unit's the nucleus, but it's the outreach from the inpatient unit that really kind of hands them to the next level for hopefully the greatest success. The idea about kind of repeat admissions. Now, I don't have a breakdown on explosive outbursts, but when I look at our admissions for a year here across our inpatient system, we get about 4,000 admissions a year. 3,000 don't come back that year. Now, about 1,000 do.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, so we have success, but a lot of those are kids with depression and anxiety. But we do have those repeat things. And what you see is those common factors oftentimes are these issues around family, holding it to the environment that they're being discharged to, and are we making the effective change we need to really help them be successful there?
But, you know, it seems to me, Mike, that what we're talking about is a pretty chronic problem. When I've looked at this, and you know I've been doing it a long time, this starts in preschool. Many of the parents will say, my kid never outgrew the terrible twos. And so you've got something that started at age 3, 4, 5, 6, The child hits the educational system, and sometimes can be accommodated there if you've got a progressive school district that's got good a good behavior modification system, a good special education system that has can get the child into the kind of environment where school isn't an additional stressor. But you're dealing with a chronic problem, and some families have often treaded water with them for a while, and then it gets to the point where you mention safety, and the child is unsafe. He or she threatens to hurt you, threatens to hurt himself, does something really destructive, and finally gets to the point where a parent will call 911, say, or in a year from now, maybe they'll call 988. But what they'll do is they'll call something, SOS, help me with this. I don't see it as a situation where this is just a little, fire that you can stomp on it and it goes out, or even get a fire extinguisher that goes out. This is often a conflagration that needs a couple of fire trucks to it. And we don't have the fire trucks. Or it seems to me that we don't conceptualize this as a longitudinal problem. It's everybody gets their little fire extinguishers out and it doesn't do any good. I don't know how you break that. Have you figured out how to do that?
Well, this idea about how disabling this condition is really, it's right on target, because the idea of a tantrum, I think, oftentimes minimizes really what's happening, and how these episodes really trip a young person up, whether it's at school or community or with family, oftentimes is very severe. And when it gets to the danger point, it can be real danger. It can be aggression towards a parent. It can be aggression towards other children. It can be towards themselves. These turn into really big issues very quickly. And we have to make sure we don't minimize these things. And so that's why that idea of, okay, how do we kind of rate this? And this is where we have a gap in the field. We really don't have kind of an acuity indexing where we could say, look, this is this level of severity this child's impaired with, and so we need this level of care or this level of intervention. We're not far enough down the road in doing this in a consistent manner. And so you get these little islands, to your point, of kind of intervention and kind of a lack of coordination. And so this idea of how we do description of these events, again, something we don't do consistently now, and we need to. But having descriptions of these events and then some severity indexing so that we can say this level of care is needed as we transition is really kind of a challenge for us in the near future.
Yeah. The CASI sort of does that, the ACAPS mm-hmm. instrument. But I think it does. I think for inpatient units, it may need its own further on CASI. You mentioned keeping the child safe. That's a great goal. But it seems to me that it's one of the things that's fairly difficult to do, because you're not supposed to isolate them. You're not supposed to put your hands on them. You've got a limited amount of space. You need to take care of the staff, that nobody wants to come to work and get their teeth kicked in. How do you keep a kid who's got this level of explosive aggression? How do you keep them safe and everybody else safe?
Well, this is, again, a challenge for us. I wish I had a clear answer for you. And we have a lot of work to do in this because I think there's some promising models out there, whether it's behavioral management models that have been shown to help decrease some of these events, whether it's things such as collaborative problem solving that seem to help. There's other models such as junior PEM that have helped in residential programming. And then like the 6-core strategies in state hospital systems. So there's things out there that seem to help. Now our measurement is still behind and that we're using seclusion restraint as proxy measure, but it does seem to indicate some improvement. The idea of how we keep them safe is, you know, so much of it, when you look at these core programs that really do seem to help, is really giving a script and a program to those frontline staff that has a consistency that is usually based on some positive affirmation of the child and focus on positive interaction. And I think our struggle oftentimes is that we have such big turnover of staff and others that we're kind of sending them in there oftentimes is, you know, just be nice and not really giving them tools to kind of really deal with these young people that have complex problems. But when you see these models of care that really focus on trying to develop a fidelity to a model of consistency, I think you see some improvement. But with those challenges we were talking about earlier, such as flow and turnover and things like that, oftentimes hard to put in place. But it's that kind of diligent as if you're leading, like a child psychiatrist is leading an inpatient unit, they really need to focus on that. How do they kind of help really direct that those direct care providers to have that consistent positive approach towards kids? And so I think there's, again, models out there that show promise, but it's the idea of putting them in place and keeping a fidelity to a model.
You know, I think one of the things that's important with that, because we used to have that on our inpatient unit. We had a very stable staff. They had a good sense of what it was the kid needed. Some of the staff were clearly better than others, but we were able to help about 80% of the kids. There's 20%, they're the disseminated tuberculosis and stage 4 breast cancer, and you know, you just don't know what to do with them. But the 80% of the kids responded to the things that you know. I mean, it's almost like a good parent. They respond to knowing that you care about them. That relationship is really important. You're much more likely to take a no from somebody that you know cares about you than a no from somebody who you just know is waiting to F you over. So the relationship is important, but it's hard to get a relationship in a couple of days. So anyway, the relationship is important. The training is important. This is tough work. This is not something that you read a book and say, oh, okay, I can go in now and solve advanced physics. This is something where you need training and you need supervision. That means that you need a core of clinicians, nurses, social workers, psychologists. You need people who know what they're doing on the unit to provide that supervision. And you need an administration looks on their task as being helpful, okay? Because the same support that we're looking for between the clinician and the child is needed between the administration and the clinician. And so if the staff is being constantly punished by the administration, they don't have the support they need to go to the front lines and manage the kids. And so, you know, we talk about systems of care. This is the kind of system that we have within an inpatient unit that I don't know people. I think the 6 core strategies, and you look at those and it reads well, but I don't know that all of that actually gets implemented. And I think when I've consulted, and I have, because, you know, I visited you at one point, when I visited inpatient units, There's often a break between the administration and the senior clinicians, and I mean the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, and also and if that ain't going well, then downstream it ain't going well.
Yep. No, I think you're on a really important point here, and in some ways, you know, here, you know, we're talking to child and adolescent psychiatrists who really are the best trained to do this work. And with the expertise that they have from their background and their focus, But you're absolutely right. They need to be supported by the administration and what they're trying to do on these inpatient units. They need to have the data in front of them. They need to get the information about things such as, you know, seclusion restraint rates are one thing, but also let's say staff injuries, or let's say level of aggression, whatever it might be. There really needs to be a quality improvement effort that they are part of the leadership of to really, really get units to function at the highest level. This idea about supporting staff is critical in that, you know, we're talking really about a high risk industry. When you look at psychiatric aides, their injury rates exceed that of police and firefighters. And unless we're doing things to help protect them and support them, they are transient. Mm-hmm. And we lose that expertise that they gain very quickly, or they never got it. Mm-hmm. The idea of how we get, to your point, good, experienced people on the front line who are equipped to deal with complex situations. And I would, you know, supervision and all that is critical. I would also say simulations. I mean, if you're confronted by a 15-year-old who is extremely explosive and you're 26 yourself and haven't ever faced that before, what do you do? We have to train people to be able to manage that. And it's oftentimes a real challenge. But I think is this investment by administration to the leadership, the physician leadership, sharing information, empowering them for positive change on those units is critical if they're going to function at the highest level.
What is your experience with PRN medication?
Well, I think PRN medication, I guess my first reaction to that is, well, it's usually too late. You know, usually by the time the PRN is given, it's too late. It kind of gets back. And the other thing is it's the inconsistency of how it's administered. Is we may think we're doing a great job by writing the order PRN agitation or explosive behavior, whatever it might be. And we can pick whatever, whether it's, whatever type of medication it might. But oftentimes when you start really looking at when is it being used, how is it being offered, at what stage of it, I think is that sometimes PRNs could be effective if we're able to give them early enough, but oftentimes is what you seem to see happen is that the explosion's already occurred, the unit's already been destroyed, and all of a sudden people are saying, well, he needs a PRN right now.
Yeah, right.
That's like okay,
well, we act.
Yeah, the boat has sailed. Yeah. So we need to figure out again more effective ways about really that stepwise intervention and when should we really put it in place and then study it, because right now is the data out there is pretty spotty.
Well, one of the things that I think the other thing that is a real conundrum in terms of this flow business is what you referred to as unit acuity, because often we know what to do when things are okay. Like you read in the literature, when you start to intervene when you see the kid huffing and puffing and, you know, with clenching fists and looking cross and so forth and so on. And, you know, that's the point at which you try to do a de-escalation, or maybe if you think a PRN is going to work, you know, you can try it at that point, but you can't. Why can't you? Well, because you've got three other kids going off and you don't have adequate staff. So you tell the kid to, you know, sit down and, you know, go away, or I don't know, you talk to him in a cross voice, I'm going to give you a timeout, or whatever the thing happens to be. And, you know, if you do an instant replay, you say, well, that isn't what I should have done. But, you know, you're a human being, you're distracted, you're stressed, you've got three other fires to put out. So I think that many times, we actually know what to do, but we're not able to do it because we've got a lot of kids on the unit that are doing that. And we have a lot of kids on the unit because they're coming up from the emergency room. And you can't say, well, listen, the unit acuity is already at 8. We're not going to take this kid, even though we've got 2 empty beds. We're not going to take that kid. I mean, that is what you should do, but you can't do it because you've got another responsibility that to do that. And so part of the difficulty, I think, is that we do need more services. We need them shaped to the way we need them shaped. We're stuck with the fact that with kids, it's a seasonal thing. So, you know, sometimes things are peaceful and quiet. Other times it's really terrible. But we know all of those things, Mike. And I think that it's frustrating sometimes that, you know, when you don't know what to do about something, that's scary, but you can admit that. It's frustrating when you know what to do and then you can't do it.
Well, you're, again, I think is really pointing out a critical issue for us as a field. And that is, you know, are we really putting the resources toward this we should be? And, you know, I remember there, we had a surgeon here that said, you know, if there was as many kids coming in, if there would be any other disease, the number of children that come in with mental health problems, there'd be a tower built just for that. Yeah, and it's true. When you start thinking about the sheer numbers of kids that have are impacted by these problems and explosive outbursts being maybe the leader of the pack, you know, we should have so much more that we're doing for these young people than what we're doing right now, because it's a disabling condition. And the idea of just like the single rooms, what other disorder do we have double rooms for besides mental health in a pediatric hospital, let's say? It doesn't exist. Just that idea. The idea of a parent being able to stay with their child overnight a lot of times doesn't exist on inpatient units in mental health or behavioral health, but in a pediatric hospital, that would be unheard of. So you see this discrepancy that I think we're beginning to see some big systems address, but we still got a long way to go. And this is why the advocacy for these young people is just critical. We have to do a lot better than what we're doing.
So I think that's a good note to end on. And in terms of advocacy, I think that's been one of the things that you've really excelled at, Dr. Sorter. I think you have been a real star in the field, and we are grateful to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you to our audience, who I hope some of you out there have appreciated some of the difficulties that we have talked about, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.
Provides Screenside Chats as a member in public service, but it is neither a legal interpretation nor a statement of ACAP policy. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by ACAP. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their participation in Screenside Chats does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of ACAP or any of its officials.